Previously on Beta.
I've been searching for the Maltese burger for 3 years.
I'm Teresa Caputo. I like to think of myself as a typical Long Island mom, but I have a very special gift. I talk to dead people.
In what state was Abraham Lincoln born?
In what state?
Mm-hmm.
Like all of us, naked and screaming.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, Rumen Alam joins us to discuss his suspenseful and resonant novel, Leave the World Behind.
God, if that's who it is, isn't telling us what's happening in the world. So there's a sense of mystery over the book. Has there been a blackout? Has a war begun? Is this an event like 9/11?
And later in the hour, author Claire McNear takes us behind the scenes of the smartest and most popular game show of all time, Jeopardy, hosted by my fellow Canadian, the late, great Alex Trebek.
He's ubiquitous in a way that just about nobody is anymore in pop culture, and also that he was so, so good at it. He worked so hard, which is what made Jeopardy so good.
But first... Every Saturday night on TCM, or Sunday morning if you're not a night owl, Eddie Muller introduces us to a film that usually features a bored detective, a sultry femme fatale, expressionist black and white lighting, and a hard-boiled voiceover.
Welcome to Noir Alley. I'm your host, Eddie Muller. To commemorate the Easter holiday, I'm presenting a film about a journalist who takes a daring risk to expose the dangers of capital punishment.
Eddie is the host of TCM's Noir Alley. He's also the author of Dark City, The Lost World of Film Noir, and the founder and president of the Film Noir Foundation. You can see why he's known as the Czar of Noir. So we parlayed with Eddie to find out why he's an ambassador of the genre, what he considers essential viewing, and how he found his love for noir on the shadowy, steep streets of San Francisco.
I think it all had to do with my father, who was not a movie fan whatsoever, but I was born very late in his life, so he was in his prime as a young man during what we now recognize as the original noir era. And so because I grew up in the late 60s and early 70s, the world looked entirely different then than it did only 25 years earlier. And I was just, and my dad was very much a public figure. He was a sports writer in San Francisco and was very much a wheel and a man about town. And so I, just watching him with his colleagues and seeing photographs of him in his prime, I was very much attracted to that earlier era. And then when I found the movies, it was like, well, this is the time. You know, it was almost like being able to revisit that time. And it always fascinated me to see the difference between the way my father was at home, where he was just dad, and this, essentially, this character he played when he was out in public, where he was a much gruffer, tougher, hard-nosed guy, you know, the typical image of like a Damon Runyon style hard-boiled sports writer. That was my dad. But he was a different person at home. And so that also kind of fascinated me. And of course, all these characters that he hung around with, I was amazed at how deferential they were to my dad, who I knew as a sweetheart at home. But, you know, these guys who I really took to be gangsters, some of them, were, you know, would curry his favor and all this kind of stuff. So all of that was fascinating to witness as well. And I think it's kind of part of how I developed this interest in noir.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the first film noir you ever saw?
Well, you know, I've been asked that question enough times that I've now developed an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's absolutely true or not, I don't really know. But I say it's Thieves' Highway, which was a Fox film from 1949 with Richard Conte and Valentina Cortesa. Because I like that one to be the first one because it is actually set in San Francisco.
Would they... They go for them in San Francisco?
They eat apples in Frisco, they ain't snobs. They'd grab them up like that.
You think Mike Figlia might be interested?
Oh, that chiseler. He'd be so crazy to get him, he might even make a straight deal.
It was a world that no longer existed when I saw the film. It was the old produce market down on the Embarcadero in San Francisco, which had long since been razed and condominiums put up. And so I was fascinated by, like, wow, there was this whole other world that existed, you know, beneath the world that we live in now. And that has always been kind of a, you know, a guiding principle of the work that I do. I'm always trying to figure out what was here right before, what led up to this, how did we get here? That's always been a fascination of mine.
Mm-hmm. What makes a film noir?
I believe the protagonists have to be compromised in some way. You know, Hollywood's job was to reassure the public. It's always been kind of a propaganda tool, right? And it's going to work out. Everything's going to end happily ever after. There was a production code that kind of enforced that whole concept. But noir, in many ways, was a resistance movement by a lot of artists to say, well, life doesn't actually work that way. And one of the ways they could do this was in genre pictures, like crime movies, in which they could show average people doing the wrong thing.
You aren't exactly the sort of a person you pretend to be, are you?
I'm not sure I know exactly what you mean.
The schoolgirl manner, you know, blushing, stammering, and all that.
I haven't lived a good life. I've been bad. Worse than you could know.
You know, that's good, because if you actually were as innocent as you pretend to be, we'd never get anywhere.
I won't be innocent.
Good.
Noir is where the protagonist do the wrong thing and don't have a moral awakening necessarily. Or if they do, it comes too late because they already have to pay the price for what they've done. So to me, that's kind of the essential thing. Looking at it from a writer's point of view, I mean, obviously there are those people who look at it stylistically for the iconography and the fantastic cinematography and the look of noir, which was very much of its time. Because if you were to make a noir film today, and it does happen, it wouldn't necessarily look like those movies from 1940 through the, you know, mid-50s. It would be a parody of that, and it wouldn't have the same intensity that the original films had.
Mm-hmm. You argue that of all the different genres of film that Hollywood produced during the days of the studio system, film noirs hold up the best. Why?
Because it was that they were made during this period where the culture as a whole was losing its innocence. That was it, right? I mean, we just fought the second war to end all wars, and it was you could no longer easily mollify people and convince them that everything was going to turn out all right. It nobody was buying that, you know. So there are other more fun reasons why noir holds up. It has a lot to do with the language, the incredibly witty vernacular speech that is so part and parcel of film noir. I mean, obviously these were beautiful films made by these incredible craftsmen that just look amazing. You don't really see a visual style associated with maybe you could argue that John Ford's Westerns have a particular visual style to them. But otherwise, no. You know, nobody talks about the visual style of screwball comedy or any, you know, musicals, of course, but that's kind of a different thing. There's just a sense, I think, that period in American history was kind of the apex in terms of style. It was like everybody dressed so well, the cars were so fantastic, the nightclubs were the best ever, the music was fantastic, and there's a sense of people wanting to retain that spirit through these movies.
Mm-hmm. You, of course, host a show called Noir Alley on TCM, Turner Classic Movies. Tell us how that came about.
TCM and I have crossed paths a few times along the way, and we're always kind of on each other's radar. I'm pleased to say that I was personally invited by Robert Osborne to his own film festival in Athens, Georgia. He used to do this every year, And I was very gratified when Robert invited me to come and co-host some films at his festival. This was prior to any engagement with TCM. So I felt like I had gotten a benediction of sorts right off the bat. And then we started doing things with TCM, and then they just very kindly, they gave me a thing on the spotlight called The Summer of Darkness that was very, very popular. And out of that 3-month Friday night gig came the weekly show.
Mm-hmm. If someone has never heard of Noir or Noir Alley, which three films would you suggest to them as kind of a starter kit to an introduction to film noir?
I would say Double Indemnity is the essential noir title. I would say Out of the Past is definitely the Robert Mitchum Jane Greer picture from 1947.
Near the plaza was a little cafe called La Mar Azul, next to a movie house. I sat there in the afternoons and drank beer. I used to sit there half asleep with the beer and the darkness. Only that music from the movie next door kept jarring me awake. And then I saw her coming out of the sun. And I knew why Witt didn't care about that 40 grand.
And then after that, it's like a throw-in for depending on the person. I would say maybe Touch of Evil or maybe, Kiss Me Deadly is an interesting film because it's such a 50s film, so it's sometimes good to show that to say, look, it wasn't just the 40s, there was also the 50s.
Let's talk a bit about Double Indemnity, which, as you just said, is the essential or definitive film noir, or maybe both. And on an episode of Noir Alley, when you showed Billy Wilder's film, the 1944 classic, you said that Double Indemnity screenplay revolutionized motion pictures. How did it do that?
It took two hugely popular stars. I mean, at that point, Barbara Stanwyck was the highest paid woman in the United States of America. And Fred McMurray was pretty much known just as a very light comedic actor. And it made them murderers. The audience does have empathy with those characters who are reprehensible. Those two characters are reprehensible in every way. That is a very, very subversive film. And if people now, a lot of people would watch that movie because we've had decades and decades of stories just like it, they may not understand just how groundbreaking that film was to put two big stars in a movie where they are such wretched characters and to somehow make them charismatic and appealing. So that when they're committing the crime and the car doesn't start when they're trying to get away from the rail yard, you're rooting for the car to start. You know, you don't want them to get caught. And that's very, very sophisticated and like I say, groundbreaking stuff for what, you know, it's not every movie that brings up these issues and then makes you confront yourself. Like, Why did I want them to get away with it?
What does that mean?
You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, the film, of course, is based on the novel by James M. Cain, and Billy Wilder and Raymond Chandler wrote the screenplay together. What changes did Wilder and Chandler make? What were the biggest changes they made to Cain's novel?
They made the language sing. James M. Cain was incredibly important figure in the development of noir on the page because his books were like tailor-made for the movies. They were short, they were punchy, they had a real sleazy vibe to them that would be part of this whole watershed moment in cinema history. But he didn't write good dialogue. It, as Chandler said, it just laid there on the page. There was nothing to it. And man, I mean, Billy Wilder is one of the greatest screenwriters of all time, and Chandler had a way with language second to none. So that was basically the biggest change in my estimation was the words they put in the mouths of the characters were very different than what Cain had written and just beautiful.
Mr. Neff, why don't you drop by tomorrow evening around 8:30? He'll be in then.
Who?
My husband. You were anxious to talk to him, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but I'm sort of getting over the idea, if you know what I mean.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
Suppose you get down off your motorcycle and give me a ticket.
Suppose I let you off with a warning this time.
Suppose it doesn't take.
Suppose I have to whack you over the knuckles.
Suppose I bust out crying and put my head on your shoulder.
Suppose you try putting it on my husband's shoulder.
That tears it.
I sometimes go into schools, and that's the scene I always show them. The scene where Fred McMurray and Stanwyck meet in Double Indemnity, because then I show it, they laugh at it, and then it opens up all this discussion about, so what's really going on in this scene? What do you think his motivations really are, and what's she all about? And all, and the kids get it completely, but I'm able to explain, well, you know, this is how they had to do it once upon a time, because for all those reasons we talked about earlier, right? I mean, the production code would not allow certain things to be shown or even discussed, and that scene has so much innuendo that it's a great primer for young people to understand how movie makers had to operate back then.
How has being the czar of noir and a noir archaeologist affected the way you view your life and the world in which we live?
I think people might be surprised at what a relentlessly optimistic person I am in terms of my own life and things, you know. Mm-hmm. Noir has served me very well. I appreciate it very, very much. And I will say this, this may be a sideways way of answering your question, but it has been incredibly gratifying over these 20 or so years, because once I started doing the film festivals, when I created the Film Noir Foundation to restore movies and all this stuff, it has been so gratifying that noir, which is all about disillusionment and alienation and the worst instincts in people, has opened up this gigantic world, which is completely international, of people who share these same interests as me. And we now have this network of people all over the world who are looking for noir films and, you know, coming to the festivals, and it's been amazing. I'm not going to say it's a cult or anything, but it's a wonderful fraternity of people. It's not even a fraternity, because it's total gender split, right? Mm-hmm. It is men and women equally who love this stuff.
Yeah. Eddie Muller, thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much, Doug. I really appreciate it.
Eddie Muller is the czar of noir. He's the host of TCM's Noir Alley and the author of Dark City, The Lost World of Film Noir. Find out more about Eddie and film noir at WPR.org/beta.
You can make a drive that you make all the time, and your GPS connection breaks, and then you suddenly are like, wait, what exit do I take? Like, how do I do this?
Ruman Alam joins us to talk about his strangely resonant suspense novel, Leave the World Behind. That's coming up in just a moment. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
There it was, undeniable. Noise. A cough, a voice, a step, a hesitation. That uncategorizable animal knowledge that there's another of the species nearby, and the pause, pregnant, to see if they mean harm. There was a knock at the door. A knock at the door of this house, where no one knew where they were, not even the global positioning system. This house near the ocean, but also lost in farmland, this house of red bricks painted white, the very material the smartest little piggy chose because it would keep him safest. There was a knock at the door.
That was author Ruman Alam, reading from a suspense novel, Leave the World Behind. The book is a provocative thriller about two families forced into a mystery that tackles race, class, consumerism, and our dependence on technology. It's even been optioned by Netflix for a movie adaptation starring Julia Roberts and Denzel Washington. We caught up with Ruman at his home in Brooklyn to talk about why his book is hitting home with so many readers and to have him summarize the enigmatic novel without spoiling anything.
I normally don't care about spoilers in books. Like, I don't think knowing what happens to Emma Bovary changes your experience of reading Madame Bovary, but there is something I want the reader to experience going into this book, a feeling of being destabilized by what the book ends up doing. So usually what I say when I'm asked this question is, Leave the World Behind is a story of a family of four from a nice part of Brooklyn, not unlike where I live. They're a middle-class family. Amanda is an ad executive, her husband Clay is a professor, and they're heading out to Long Island for a week-long vacation with their teenage children. And on the second night of their stay in this house they rented on Airbnb, there is a knock at the door. And they meet an older Black couple who have come saying that this is their house, that they've rented it to them on Airbnb, and that they've fled there because there's been a blackout in New York City. Their cell phones aren't working. The television line doesn't seem to be working. There's no internet service. So no one can really verify what's happening. And from that moment, the book shifts from being a book about a family of four on vacation to being about a book about six people inside of a house trying to figure out what's happening in the world outside. But I wanted to use that space to write a story that seemed to be a story about family life, which I think it is, but was also a story about our politics, our culture, about art, about family, about what's happening in the world, about global climate change, all of these other very big issues. So I wanted to go from the very small microcosm of a family to a very big novel engaged with thinking about what defines contemporary life.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you did, and you did it so very well.
Thank you.
Are there any particular books, writers, or films that influenced Leave the World Behind?
I do think that you're always working with a palette of reference, right? Like, nothing is born in a vacuum. And so when I was thinking about wanting to write a book that contained or deployed the conventions of horror, I had to familiarize myself with those. So I read Pet Sematary by Stephen King. I read a book called I'm Thinking of Ending Things by Ian Reid, which has recently become a film. It's a wonderful book.
Yes, my fellow Canadian. Yeah, it's a great book.
Really wonderful book that really shows how you can artfully use language and, you know, the unexpected to destabilize the reader and to make a point beyond a thrill or a scare, you know? I was thinking a lot about film and drama in particular. I was thinking about Mike Nichols' adaptation of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, the great Edward Albee play, which is an extraordinary and very atmospheric film about people in this very convivial atmosphere with a sense of menace just below the surface. There's a wonderful film by Michael Haneke called Funny Games, which he made, he remade again an English version of, that's an extraordinary movie about a family on vacation that is interrupted by explosive and unthinkable violence, inexplicable violence. So yeah, I think there was a language of reference that I was thinking about. There's always that particular tension between, you know, art and influence of wanting to sort of know what you're excited by and know what these other masterful artists are doing, but wanting to do your own thing. So trying to learn something from Stephen King, but also not rip Stephen King off, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. One of the most surprising moments I experienced while reading your book is the way you use omniscient narration. Readers know all of the characters' thoughts and feelings. Why did you choose this point of view?
That's a really astute question. The early drafts of this book, the reader is sitting watching these six people try to figure out what's happening. And the reader feels the same sense of frustration as the characters do, because the reader can't make heads or tails of what's happening. And it's as simple as, I mean, the takeaway advice here is to listen to your editor. So my editor said to me, the reader needs to know what the characters don't because it's annoying. At a certain point, the reader is going to demand more. And that was a great note, because I had this tool at my disposal, which is the voice of the book itself. And so the book in subsequent drafts was revised to be told almost from the perspective of God, where the voice of the book is able to tell you what each character is thinking. It's able to tell you when the characters are lying, and it's able to do the thing that the characters can't do, which is move outside the walls of the house. And it can drop hints and suggestions. God, if that's who it is, isn't telling us what's happening in the world. So there's a sense of mystery over the book. Has there been a blackout? Has a war begun? Is this an event like 9/11? The voice of the book declines to clarify that, but it does provide some information. I like to think of it almost like the reader turns into Claire Danes in the TV show Homeland, which with her big, you know, sort of like board of papers and trying to connect these complicated dots. But it's actually impossible to, because it doesn't give you enough information to assemble a picture of what might be happening in the world beyond this house. Because I think ultimately that's not interesting. What's interesting is not what this undetermined event is. What's interesting is how these characters are responding to it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In your book, Amanda tells her husband, Clay, that he is terrible with faces. I'm curious, is this something you struggle with?
I am terrible with faces. That's a... So one of the funny things about this book that you may notice when I say this is that I don't describe what anyone really looks like. And in part, that's because I don't really see faces well. And my husband, by contrast, is actually like extraordinary with faces. Like, I've had this experience with him so many times where we'll be out at a restaurant and he'll say, "Oh, do you see that person over there? 6 years ago, they waited on us at when we were buying something at Barney's." Like, it's really, he's like a super recognizer. He's really good at spotting celebrities, and I'm terrible at it. So I am not good with faces. And so in a way that does inform my practice as a writer, I build character using material object or using class cues as opposed to describing a haircut or describing the shape of a face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You wrote Leave the World Behind before the COVID-19 pandemic, but it was published during the pandemic. How do you think that this affects the way readers experience your book?
Well, I mean, hugely, because when I wrote this book in 2019, lay people had never heard of a coronavirus, right? Myself included. Pandemic was not on my mind. Our politics were on our mind, but the pandemic was not. So I thought I had done something very clever, which is to find a metaphor in being trapped inside of a domestic space to describe the condition of being trapped on a planet that we are seemingly committed to destroying, or being trapped inside of a system of government that is clearly not functioning. It seemed like a leap at the time that I was writing it, right? It seemed like an act of imagination. What's happened in the months since is that that has become literalized. Coronavirus has literalized the experience of being trapped, because many of us are staying at home, not sending our children to school, trying to work from home. So we are all starting to chafe a little bit and understanding our own homes as a trap as opposed to a refuge. It's a strange resonance. It's a strange, strange coincidence. There is a reader who will find this uncomfortable to read given this context. But I hope that there's also a reader who will find it illuminating, that what the book is doing feels very present because it mirrors the conditions that the reader herself finds herself in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. There are a lot of themes in your novel. You're tackling race, class, consumerism, and ennui. Why was it so important for you to weave all of these themes into your narrative?
It's such a strange situation that is being described in this book. It's such an outsized thing. It goes so quickly from being realist to being surreal and strange and absurd. So it felt important to me to be fixed in the concerns of this particular moment, which to me are, or maybe just the concerns of American life, of consumerism, of technology and our reliance on technology and our sort of our belief that technology and connection will save us. It's like, it's what the book wants to pick at. It's using a very big, absurd scenario to talk about the reality that we actually live in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you mentioned the theme of technology, and that's also a big theme, too, in terms of how dependent we become on technology and our phones especially. And once you remove that tech from your characters, it seems like they kind of return to a primal set of instincts.
Yes, and I think that we've all kind of had that weird experience of the frustration of not being able to check your email, or a particular irritation of you're driving somewhere and you lose your GPS service, and then you're like, well, I need to rely on logic or my own grasp of the geography of the world around me. And you can find that muscle a little atrophied. Like, you can make a drive that you make all the time, and your GPS connection breaks, and then you suddenly are like, wait, what exit do I take? Like, how do I do this? Which is extraordinary, because I'm only 43, and I can remember an experience of adulthood that was not thus defined. I can remember an experience of adulthood that required writing down which exit you took off of the highway. So in a very short period of time, we have allowed our reality to be redefined by technology. It's a strange thing. It's a really strange thing. And when I think about my own children's experience of the world, it will be very different than my own. I don't know if they'll ever have the skill set of looking at the kind of road atlas you used to have to keep in the glove box and figuring out how to get from this highway to that country road, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was particularly intrigued by this whole idea that once you're stripped of technology, you have so little knowledge about what actually goes on in the world, and that the character of Clay seems to be the spokesman for this theme. He's often doubting himself and questioning why he doesn't know how to do certain things. At times, he seems to feel very emasculated and useless. Why did you want to include this theme?
I mean, in some ways, I think that's how I feel. I think I don't have... I don't have a sense of being able to do anything useful. I could write a book review for you if that's what you needed, but I'm not sure I could repair a washing machine. And last year when I had to repair my washing machine, I had to watch a YouTube video to figure out how to get the hose drain cleared so that the drum would start spinning again. And I could do that. I could go on YouTube and do that and figure out how to do it. And I felt such a sense of accomplishment, but then also so like chastened by my realization that I'd never have been able to puzzle that out. And I understand that, or I poke fun at it in this book as a sort of masculine condition. I don't think it's exclusively the province of men, but I do think that Clay in the book wants to be the dad. He wants to be the hero. He wants to roll his sleeves up and solve the problem. And he has to confront the fact that he actually just can't do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really bad. I guess that's why I was very intrigued by this theme and really related to Clay, because I'm really bad at fixing things. I'm not good at that, whereas my wife, Catherine, is great at that. Lucky for me. So at one point in the novel, G.H. is told he looks like Denzel Washington. Now, Sam Esmail, the creator of the TV series Mr. Robot, is going to direct a film adaptation of your book starring Julia Roberts as Amanda and Denzel Washington. You made the casting director's job pretty easy with that. Are you making the screenwriter's job easy too, in the sense that are you possibly writing the screenplay?
So Sam is going to write the screenplay, which okay. I think is very exciting. It's in such capable hands there. I'm so curious to know what choice he's going to make with that particular observation inside of the book. When Amanda says that G.H. looks like Denzel Washington, it will create a strange, like, postmodern problem for Sam to solve in his screenplay. But I think he's such an extraordinary writer. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Mr. Robot is an incredible show. Homecoming, in which he directed Julia Roberts, is just such an incredible work. Really, just Sam's interest in the particular discomfort of contemporary reality is just so, it's just so beautifully, he has a very defined aesthetic interest. And I think this material spoke to him means a great deal to me. And I'm really excited to see what he does with it.
Yeah, me too. So you're not involved with the film in any way.
No, yeah, I trust that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
It's his problem to solve now.
Yeah, yeah. Very well said. Rumen Alam, thank you very much.
Amazing. This was so great. Thank you so much.
Ruman Alam is the author of Leave the World Behind. Find out more about Ruman at WPR.org/beta.
And what Chuck Forrest did is he decided that he thought he could get an advantage by confusing his opponents. And the way he did that was he just jumped all over the board kind of at random.
Author Claire McNear joins us to take us behind the scenes of the world's smartest game show, Jeopardy. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. This is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. The answer is America's favorite game show. If you're not saying what is Jeopardy right now, author Claire McNear is here to change your mind. She's the author of Answers in the Form of Questions, a definitive history and insider's guide to Jeopardy! Jeopardy! Has been a television mainstay for 36 years and, according to Claire, is pretty much one of the last pieces of monoculture we have left. So we decided to zoom in with Claire to find out why, and also to challenge her to a beta version of Jeopardy! I'll be posing answers to her, and she'll be providing provocative questions. Claire says that a big reason for Jeopardy!'s longevity was the hard work and universal likability factor of my fellow Canadian, the late Alex Trebek.
A beautiful thing about him was that he was really exactly who he seemed like he was on the show. I mean, he was a very kind of scholarly person who really cared about all these silly facts. He really thought they were important and built Jeopardy! Into this kind of corner of the world where that was revered, which felt, you know, especially precious in recent years, I think. He also really did have a sense of humor about it, though. You know, he was not the kind of uncharitable Saturday Night Live Will Ferrell character of himself, where he looked down on his contestants and couldn't wait to get out of there, and, you know, just, he was the only one who knew anything.
And finally, with negative $130,000, Sean Connery is here yet again.
I wouldn't miss it for the world, Trebek. I turned down Harry friggin' Potter for this.
Please, God, take me now.
He was really very charitable and had a great sense of humor about it.
What did Alex Trebek think of Will Ferrell's impersonation of him?
Yeah, this is one of the questions that Alex Trebek would always get asked. People always wanted to know, hey, aren't you offended by that? Isn't that mean? And in a way, you would think that he would have been, because it is just this extremely uncharitable depiction of him, really, where he's mean, he's condescending. But in fact, he loved it. He loved those sketches. He so had a sense of humor about himself. You know, I think it was all in good fun. And he himself had some cameos on SNL and brought Will Ferrell into Jeopardy. So they kind of had this back and forth interplay. But he actually said that he always preferred the Eugene Levy version. And he said that the reason for that was because Eugene Levy was even ruder, even meaner, even angrier.
The answer is, this Jeopardy! Champion once told Claire McNear that this is the Moneyball era of Jeopardy!
You know, I think I've heard that from a couple different contestants, but I think, who is Ken Jennings?
Yes.
Ken told me that, and he also, you know, graciously wrote the foreword to my book. So he talked a bit about this kind of professionalization that I was mentioning earlier. He compared contestants nowadays to fighter pilots, where they're getting hours and hours and hours and hours in the tank before they ever walk into the Jeopardy! Studio. Like in the old days, maybe you'd make 100 flashcards. You know, you just get the presidents down. Maybe you'd flip through an almanac, and you were like, okay, I'm ready for Jeopardy! Not so anymore.
What's the origin story of Jeopardy?
It goes back to the 1950s quiz show scandals, where there were these, you know, controversies around mega popular quiz shows like 21. And basically the producers had been helping those contestants cheat, had been giving them the answers, you know, helping them study, having their opponents throw games, really just like doctoring storylines. So it became a huge, huge scandal. It was front page news, and there was a congressional hearing, and a bunch of the contestants who did this, it was like a couple dozen of them, were convicted of perjury, and it was a sensation. And after that, Congress amended the Communications Act to effectively make cheating on a quiz show illegal. There is a federal law dictating this. So in the years after that, Merv Griffin, the kind of game show impresario who also invented Wheel of Fortune, was speaking with his wife. And She had the idea of just flipping it around and doing exactly what was now verboten, what was now illegal, and just give the answer to the contestants as a way to kind of like thumb their nose at this new law that had sort of made it so quiz shows didn't really happen anymore because everybody was so spooked. And it, of course, became the sensation. And I mean, it is a gimmick to some degree, though, the what is who is format, but it is so catchy. And it really does have this beautiful history within the broader history of television.
As you say in your book, two of the main areas of preparing to be a Jeopardy contestant are the buzzer and the subject matter. Let's talk about both of these, starting with the buzzer. How important is being good with the buzzer to being successful on Jeopardy?
Oh my God, it is so, so, so important. And that is one of the things that people really obsess over as they prepare to go on the show. The way the buzzer works on Jeopardy is, as the host, as Alex Trebek, reads a clue, there is a person sitting at the judge's table just off stage that you can kind of see along that line, who's a researcher when they're not actually taping shows, but when they are, he is listening to Trebek. And the moment Trebek finishes the last word of a clue, he flips a literal switch in front of him, and that activates these lights that you can't see when you're watching on television, but these lights along the sides of the board. And that tells the three contestants that the buzzers have been activated. And why that matters is if they ring in even a fraction of a second before those lights go on, they're locked out for a quarter of a second, which on Jeopardy is a really big deal because your opponents are probably going to swoop in and get it instead. The trickiest thing, though, is you don't really know if you've got it until you're there in the Jeopardy studio that day. You get each new contestant gets just a really brief morning warm-up session actually behind the contestant lecterns with the actual buzzers where they play part of a practice game, you know, for not any money. And they get just a moment to, you know, maybe get the hang of the buzzer. But if they realize, oh my God, I keep going too early. I don't know what I'm doing. Sorry, like you're sent off. And the next time you pick up the buzzer, you will be playing your game of Jeopardy on camera.
Yeah. What did you learn about subject matter from talking to contestants and Jeopardy champions?
You can't really learn everything that's going to be in an episode of Jeopardy. There is this pervasive misconception that contestants are given a study guide that they'll prepare. Most contestants have about 4 weeks between being called, invited to come tape, and when they actually go in, and people do study, but they are certainly not giving a study guide because that would be a violation of that federal law. What they choose to do with that 4 weeks is really interesting. And so some very smart, analytically inclined people have tried various ways to basically dig into the vast reservoir of past Jeopardy episodes and figure out specifically what sorts of subjects appear in that. And some of them have been very successful as well.
Chuck Forrest is a 5-time Jeopardy champion and a former record holder. He had an innovative approach that he used when picking categories and clues off the board. It's called the Forrest Bounce. What is the Forrest Bounce?
If you think of watching a traditional episode of Jeopardy, almost any episode of Jeopardy that you might watch and might turn on any given Wednesday, people tend to move down the categories clue by clue. You start with the $100 or the $200 clue and you move down sequentially through the board. And what Chuck Forrest did is he decided that he thought he could get an advantage by confusing his opponents. And the way he did that was he just jumped all over the board kind of at random, low-value clues, high-value clues, just switching up categories. Because the categories usually have a vital clue about what the answer might be, right? It's not just telling you it's presidents, it's like presidents, but they've hidden a funny word in there somewhere, you know, and if you're not paying close attention, you're going to miss that clue and you're probably going to get the clue wrong. So he did that, and that has remained a popular strategy, and people have kind of finessed it a little bit. So James Holzhauer famously did not play top to bottom. He played across the bottom of the board and slowly worked his way up. And that wasn't the Forrest Bounce because he wasn't trying to confuse his opponent so much as he was just trying to rack up a lot of cash really quickly. But it is controversial with viewers, right? Because it also has this disorienting effect on people watching from their own couch.
Besides clue selection, the other major strategy that is important for success on Jeopardy is wagering. What did you find out about betting strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are kind of in a moment of change for that as well, because I think James Holzhauer showed that you could bet really aggressively. And, you know, if you had the trivia goods to back it up, you could make a lot of money. You could really box out your opponents pretty effectively. You also have to be really good at the buzzer. I mean, you have to be really good at a lot of things to play the way that he did. But I think that he showed that it is often worthwhile to be very aggressive with daily doubles, for example. And he was not the first to do this, of course. Like Alex Jacob famously did this. Arthur Chu famously did this. These other storied contestants who were able to rack up really large amounts of money and box out their opponents by taking kind of gutsy wagers. And I think the ones who have done that effectively are people who know specifically what categories they're good at. And not just saying like, well, you know, I was an English major, so probably I'm good at literature. These are people who know what Jeopardy means when there's a literature category. They know the like 350 books that Jeopardy is thinking about specifically. And they bet accordingly. It's a really kind of cold, rational choice that they make in this high stakes environment, which is of course why I think a gambler did quite well with it.
The answer is an audio daily double. Claire, you have $15,000 and you're currently leading. How much would you like to wager?
You know what? In spite of knowing that the experts say, you know, to go big, I'm a more cautious person, so I'm going to say $5,000.
Okay, $5,000. So not a true daily double, but a sizable amount, one third. Here we go. The man behind this parody of a popular song by the Greg Kinne Band may be the reason that Jeopardy still exists today.
Oh, I know this one. Who is Weird Al Yankovic?
Absolutely. Well done. Very good, Claire. So, Claire, tell us, how did Weird Al and his song I Lost on Jeopardy ensure the existence of Jeopardy?
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. I had heard rumors that he was somehow involved, that his parody of that song had somehow resulted in Jeopardy coming back with Alex Trebek, and the timeline kind of matches up. So I set about investigating this, and I got on the phone with Weird Al. Basically, what happened was he was a fan of the original Jeopardy as a child. He really loved the Art Fleming version in the 60s and 70s. And he, knowing nothing of the fact that Merv Griffin was in that moment trying to launch his own Jeopardy reboot with Alex Trebek, just started to create a parody. He was very early in his career, and it had nothing to do really with the modern iteration of the show that was about to happen. But it just so happened that his song came out and it was this sensation. There was so much nostalgia around Jeopardy and it really took off. Like it was really high up on the charts. And it was just as the new Jeopardy staff was being hired and just before Jeopardy came back on the air with Alex Trebek. And I think that it is widely thought that the success of that song and the nostalgia that it kind of brought about had a lot to do with the new Jeopardy taking off. Game shows are not traditionally a very stable business. Obviously, there are these kind of cherished stalwarts, but Alex Trebek had been out of work for a year. He had worked for a series of game shows that, you know, had lasted, I think the longest was maybe 3 seasons prior to Jeopardy. You know, there's a lot of turmoil in that. And because Weird Al had created this song, it may have really been the key to Jeopardy immediately finding that audience.
It's time now for Final Jeopardy. Today's Final Jeopardy category is acknowledgements. Claire McNear, you're leading with $25,000, a sizable lead, I might add. And now it's time to write down how much you'd like to wager. And are you ready for the answer?
I think I will go all in on this, see how it goes.
Okay, there you go, all in. So for $50,000, and if you are correct, this will give you the win. This colleague of Claire McNear first encouraged her to cover Jeopardy like a sport.
That is my my wonderful editor, Andrew Gruttadaro, who really every time I wrote about Jeopardy, he was like, just go deeper, get weirder, like really just attack this thing and report it out. And, I remember writing a story about the buzzer when James Holzhauer was still in the middle of his streak. And it was 3,000 words long. It was way too long. It was just this ridiculous niche. Who wants this? Who cares? And he was just, you know, fully supportive of that. And, you know, and it took off, and in a way it led to this book. So I'm so thankful for him and for the rest of my colleagues at The Ringer.
And well, you should be. Just one moment, Claire. I've got to talk to our judges. Oh, that's right, Claire. I regret to inform you. You probably didn't notice this, but you did not phrase it in the form of a question. But that's okay. Oh, no. We're gonna give it to you anyway because we're feeling generous today.
It's
so
very
way
gracious.
To go, way to go,
man.
Claire McNair.
You are
our new Jeopardy champion with a total of $50,000. We'll see you back here tomorrow, which of course will just be a few hours later since we tape a bunch of shows in one day. So looking forward to that, Claire McNair. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Claire McNair is the author of Answers in the Form of Questions, a definitive history and insider's guide to Jeopardy. You can find out more about Claire and Jeopardy at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Eddie Muller, Ruman Alam, and Claire McNair.
I'd like to know about your podcast.
Subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
You were escorted out of an Apple store.
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
You were an underwear model.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. Take care and stay safe. I'm Doug Gordon.
You get applause and money.